If you could please join me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we stand, just to recognize that this is one of the primary places, not the only place, but certainly one of the primary places, the ordinary preached word, the ordinary, there's nothing extraordinary, the ordinary word, the ordinary waters, which point to our once and for all washing, an ordinary meal, which speaks of our forgiveness and ongoing presence of God. So these are all ordinary acts which God uses to meet us and to encounter us. So I'd like to begin in just verse 1. We're going to read all the way until we get to verse 18. It begins this way. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all of humankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He means John the Baptist. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light so that through him all might trust, all might believe. He himself, though, was not that light. He came only as a pointer. He came as a witness to the light. The true light, however, that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was created, made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who trusted in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and the only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, "This is the one that I was telling you all about. He comes after me, and yet he's beyond me. He surpassed me because he was before me. Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given, for the law was given." He sees that as a sign of grace as well. "For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth, though, come through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the one and the only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, he has made him known." These are the staggering, inspired words of God. You may be seated. In 1998, so I think I was a freshman, just about, in high school, my brother and I, we took a drive from Grand Rapids, Michigan, that's where I'm from, and we went 2.5 hours to this little town called Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was August, and it was hot, and we went to something which was at the time called Media Day. And this is when they would allow you to interact a little more with the team prior to the beginning of the season. They don't allow that anymore. And so we're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, University of Michigan. And we are this sort of, we're like this wandering the streets, enjoying ourselves as this sort of gaggle of, you know, gangly, awkward teenage years. And if I recall, I wish I was looking for a photo, and I'm going to find it. But at the time I had like frosted tips. Like, I don't know if you, this is when I thought hair was cool, so I don't anymore. But so frosted tips, I had like multitude of ear piercings, and I had an oversized Michigan jersey, number 32 to be exact. Anthony Thomas was his name. And so there we were together, my brother and I, and he's 4 years younger than I. And then we see this crowd of people gathering around, and then my brother sees them, and we didn't know quite what to do, but there he was, standing there with his freshly minted jersey. Hadn't been worn yet in a game, so I hadn't seen, you know, grass stains on it, and the helmets were still in their glory, and they hadn't been dinged up, and we knew we had to do something. Like, no enemy was going to be too strong. No crowd was going to be too big. We had to make our way to them and secure for ourselves bragging rights for the rest of our Michigan fandom days. And so we started. We started elbowing. We started jostling. We started uttering maybe badly conjugated verbs. And we finally got there. The mission was complete. We had secured for ourselves a relic from none other than this man. His name is, anybody know who he is? No? Okay, all right, just wondering. So yeah, his name was Tom Brady. There was another guy there by the name of Drew Henson. You could care less, I assume. But there we had it. We had our relic from one Mr. Tom Brady, our bragging rights for our Michigan fandom lore. And I admit, most of those details to me are still a bit sketchy, so I was trying to get the photo. It'd be interesting if I had my brother up here and he could give you the other side of that story. But in my mind, that's sort of how I remember it. That was our sort of brush with fame. But when I look back at that moment, I think what mesmerized me the most was like the juxtaposition between these two worlds that didn't seem to go together, right? Brady belonged, in my mind, to, and this is before anybody knew who he was, and we didn't know who he was going to become, and most of us didn't even want him to play quarterback at Michigan at the time, but he belonged, in my mind, to the world of immortal, and just being on that team, and I belonged to the world of awkward teenager, frosted tips, baggy jersey land, like that, like those worlds, that those two worlds could ever share the same space-time continuum, sort of like threw a shock into my fanboyness, threw a shock into my system, if you will. And since then, of course, that shock has long disappeared. But the feeling of those two worlds that didn't belong, that I had somehow been visited by an alien, that did not go away. And the closest thing I've seen to that, like on somebody's face, is like my buddy and I, we took our sons to a Michigan game, and they got to fist pump Jim Harbaugh, as well as who now will be at some point the starting quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings. I know, boo. His name's J.J. McCarthy, and I watched my son's boys high-five these characters. And we were standing way back from the mix, but I just remember seeing their eyes, like these two worlds. They were just like baffled that they could actually touch the hand of, at least in their eyes, these people from a different land, that they had been visited by aliens, if you will. And yet, how unlike the birth of Jesus any of this is. How unlike the birth of Jesus, my brush with Brady, when you start taking into account the snake crusher of Genesis 3, the descendant of Abraham, literally the God of the Exodus story, the son of David, the one Daniel calls the son of man, that he would ever brush shoulders with the first century people of Israel makes any encounter, no offense to your brush with fame, I don't know what your brushes with fame have been, but no offense made to Tom Brady, but it makes even those encounters like that seem utterly unnoteworthy and trivial. And I'm afraid when I look back at it, it was utterly unnoteworthy. But then I think just how unlike Tom Brady's entrance into the world and on the world stage was compared to the birth of Christ, in the sense of, you know, he had that freshly minted jersey, the cleats had never been and touched grass yet, and the helmets shining in the noonday sun, and then in Christ's sort of smelly entrance into the world, or even just the stages. Right? When you think just the stages on which they came, you know, Christ, Brady comes in on this, let's just admit, the greatest football stadium of all time, the largest, actually, American football stadium in the world. It's where legends are born. I know Lambeau Field, it's important to y'all here, but I think that was built in the 50s or something like this. I mean, other than the Rose Bowl and Notre Dame Stadium, but like there's only a few where legends are born. So I think of that stage compared to this podunk town of Bethlehem. It'd be like sort of me today stumbling into Tom Brady. And now like post all the achievements. And let's just count those up, right? I think the hero's here. I think, what's Brett Favre? He's not a hero anymore. But Brett Favre has how many? One. That's good. Aaron Rodgers, also I think he's considered a hero. That's, how many? Not anymore? He's got one. Yeah, Tom's got seven. 7 Super Bowls. It'd be like me running into him after all the fame at a urinal at a rest stop in Kansas. Or it'd be like me running into him at a pulpería in Siwatepeque, a podunk town in Honduras, as he's getting water and a bag of chips. Hey, Tom. It'd be that. It wouldn't make any sense. And yet, again, how unlike the birth of God is to anything. How unlike the birth of God is anything else that's ever happened or ever will happen. The implications of Jesus' birth rest in large part on one particular passage, this particular passage in the Bible, but it's not an ordinary passage by any means. The start of John's story might be, perhaps, the most poetically charged set of verses ever written, not just in the Bible, but anywhere, in any literature, making the implications, I think, so rich in terms of what we mean when we celebrate Christmas, that no matter how many sermons are preached on it, no matter how many great thinkers we get around the passage, no matter how many people we get to think about the event that is Christmas morn, we're never going to scratch the surface of the implications of this story. And one of those passages we just read together, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and then the Word was God. Which implies that the person who was born on Christmas morn was God. It implies that the person who was born in this world, in the human flesh, was God, and yet somehow also God's own child. It is perhaps the verse, more than any other, that fundamentally changes what we mean when we say we are Christians. Fundamentally changes what we're celebrating when we say the Christmas season and this first Sunday of Christmas. At Christmas, God appears to be born, not just as a collectivity, not just as a individual, somehow this eternal relationship that has always existed through which all the world has been made. And then John doesn't stop there. John goes even further. He says this in verse 5. He says, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." That single verse, by the way, subverts like 2,000 years of philosophical speculation. You could even say John's like, yeah, you know, in terms of human thought up to this point, I'm just going to flip all that upside down. I'm going to throw a wrench into your thinking there. I'm going to hijack centuries of human thinking. That image of light and darkness, along with comparing light to knowledge or light to enlightenment in the 18th century, and darkness as ignorance, is as old as human thinking, is as old as human thought. But there's a difference in how John is employing it. There's a difference in the way that he's using this language of light and darkness compared to how it was commonly used up to that point. For today, I'll stick to just one. I'll stick to one particular passage in John's words, though it's hardly any just a passage. How many of you have ever had a brush not with just fame? How many of you have ever had a brush with a philosophy course? Ever? Okay, some of you. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not going to try. But if you had any philosophy, 101, maybe something in high school, junior high, college, something like this, you have had to at least heard of Plato's, it's found in his 7th book in the Plato's Republic, called The Allegory of the Cave. How many of you have ever heard of The Allegory of the Cave? Okay, so if you know this story, I won't belabor it too much, but it's basically a story of these prisoners who are sitting in the dark. They're sitting in darkness. All they can see is what is in front of them, this cave wall. The only thing is they're chained to the ground, and they cannot see behind them. They can't understand. Unbeknownst to them, there is a flame, and there are people walking, holding up things and so forth that are, and again, it's just a metaphor. They don't understand where those things, all they're seeing is their reality. They're seeing these things, they don't know why they're there, but they're there on the wall and they can't turn around. But then all of a sudden, somebody breaks out of the cave. Somebody breaks out of the darkness, sort of what I would call Truman Show style, if you know that film. Have you ever seen Truman Show? It's one of my favorite films. It's a sort of modern day equivalent to The Allegory of the Cave, though with a twist, because at the end you find out all these people, of course, throughout the film are watching him, though Truman's not living in a cave. He's living on a studio set. He's been adopted by a director, and this is the last scene, spoiler alert, this is the last scene where he's just about to head out. His director is trying to tell him not to because he's figured out through a bunch of different hints, somebody who's come from offset, onset, told him you're living in a studio and all of this. And so just before he walks out of that scene, he says his famous line, good morning, good afternoon, if I don't see you again, good morning, good afternoon, and good night. And then he walks out of the cave. He walks out of the studio. And there's a twist because everybody's watching him in the cave. Everybody's watching him in the studio. So which person's in the cave, the person being entertained by the story or the person in the cave? There's more to it. But the point is, it's a modern day equivalent to the allegory of the cave. But when they finally get out of the studio, or when they get out of the cave, they rush back into the cave to tell everybody the good news, to tell them that there's a big wide world out there, and you should go see it. And of course, the people in the cave mock the person who's been freed, and they choose to not leave. They choose to resume living in darkness, watching these images flash on the screen. Now, the many parallels and the differences we could draw between, say, John, what John's talking about here. And by the way, Plato's Republic, the allegory of the cave, was written 400 years before, almost 400 years before the book of John was ever written. I want us to focus on just one thing in order to gain a true understanding in Plato's world. In order to understand reality, in order to understand life, you had to break yourself free. You had to break yourself free of the darkness. The chains that bound run towards the light. Of course, the light for Plato wasn't the material world. The light was, say, knowledge or the form of ideas. It's not by accident that 18th century folks, the Enlightenment, they use a similar language. Light is knowledge. Light would ultimately be reason, human reason, or if you remember Francis Bacon, you might have heard this campaign, knowledge is power, right? That's how we, and then of course World War I happened, World War II, and then we're like, hey, we're not as free as we think we are. But my point is, the image of light was used to speak of the very thing that could free us as human beings, knowledge, reason, these kinds of things. In other words, to be free, you and I, to be free as human beings, we had to climb out of the cave. We had to drag ourselves out of the chains that bind us. These chains could be ignorance, right? A lack of knowledge. These chains could be, in the case of the Enlightenment, it could be religion that was holding us in bondage and superstition. Well, the masses, they continue to live. They continue to live in darkness. They continue to live according to their emotions. They continue to be chained to their ignorance. They continue to be chained to their superstitions. They continue to be chained to maybe the material well, like the material world, so maybe they, you know, intemperance rather than temperance, they desire pleasure, things like that. So we have to free ourselves out of the darkness while people out inside of the cave, ultimately, they continue to live in that darkness and enchained, if you will. But in other words, to be free, we have to free ourselves. And this is at the core of what Plato, or 18th century, the only way to be truly free was to climb out. The only way to be free is to aim higher, to ascend. And then, of course, bring that good news back into the cave and let everybody else know. Why do I bring that up on a day like this? If you start in John's story, again, written 400 years later, he starts where? In the exact opposite direction. The complete reversal of direction. It's not us who climb out of a dark cave. We are told in this story, it is a light that has come from outside of us that has shined in our darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. And that light has brought with it the fruit of God's grace. That light, verse 12, has brought with it the ability to also be called children of God. And this is, by the way, deeply connected to the rest of the Bible, the whole story. It's not Abraham who climbed his way to God. It's God who showed up in Abraham's life literally out of nowhere. It's not the people of God who chose God in the relationship, it's rather God, and he says this on multiple occasions, it's God who shows up in the life of Israel, making promises to them, binding himself out of his goodness and mercy to them. So how appropriate then that what we are celebrating on and in the Christmas season is that God came to actually dwell in the cave, to rub shoulders with us, to dwell with us, rather than expect us to drag ourselves out, rather than expect us to drag ourselves to the light. That ladder could be logic, that ladder could be reason, that ladder could be mystical experience, there's a lot of different ladders. We've tried all of these. One of them is the Babel story. It didn't end well. The image that John gives us in this Christmas story is fundamentally different. It's fundamentally different than every ancient, say, philosophical way in which we are to drag ourselves out, but it's also fundamentally different than even every religious story that has been written as well. In fact, the religious story is that you have to reach God. That's the definition of religion, that you have to aim your life to God and then God will respond. Or in the philosophical vein, it would be you have to aim higher. But John's story here is written from a fundamentally opposite direction. And by the way, there's no shortage of stories in, say, ancient religious texts of, so I think sometimes we think, you know, the Christian story is the only one where God becomes a creature. That's not true. There are plenty of ancient religions where gods become creatures. One of them is this man Zeus. He becomes a bird on many occasions, but he becomes a bird to basically become, to lure, in some cases, princess. He comes to rape one particular princess Europa. He comes to swoon other women. He comes to take advantage, assault, and things like this. He becomes a bull. So he becomes a bird. He becomes a bull. In one of the stories also where gods become creatures, this was done in one of Rembrandt's. It's hard to see. But to your right, you have Jupiter and Mercury. And in their story, they basically show up on the scene in the world in a VW bus going around to different towns and different villages. Looking for hospitality, looking to be cared for, taken in, given a warm meal in this case. And the one couple that takes them in is to the left. That'd be Philemon and Baucis. And that's an elderly couple who take them in, these gods, and show them service and, you know, love and care and a warm bed and some food and things like this. And as a reward, Jupiter and Mercury give them a bowl of wine that will not run out, allow them to be in charge of a shrine, so they make them priests, and then ultimately, and this would be the hope for any human being, that they could become gods themselves. Whereas the rest of the towns that they showed up to that didn't accept them, didn't serve them, they destroyed. They destroyed those homes, they destroyed the people who didn't show them hospitality. But the Christmas story is fundamentally different. Fundamentally different. The birth of Jesus, the incarnation of God, God showing up in the flesh, is becoming human. It's not just your ordinary God becomes a creature story. There's something qualitatively different about this God when he becomes human. For one, Jesus didn't come ravishing and assaulting women and showing them that, you know, he deserved them. For another, he didn't come flexing, despite in the passage that we just read, we are told that though the world was created through him, the world didn't recognize him. So this Jesus didn't come saying, you better believe I'm in charge and you better believe I have power here. But it's also true this God didn't come seeking to be served or seeking to be shown hospitality or a warm bed. In fact, in Mark, famously, John says, or Jesus says, for even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Or as John here in John 1 says, so that we can call ourselves children of God. What makes the Christmas story then for John so fundamentally different than every other story? I'm talking about ancient philosophical stories, but also every religious story, ancient and modern. It's this. It's how we gain our freedom. It's how we gain life. It's how we say, rise higher. And in the Christian story, in the Christmas story, it always comes, and in John's story, it always comes from outside of us. It's a light that comes and shines in our cave, in our life, not the other way around. To this day, and you can find them everywhere, there are ancient stories like this. The philosophical story is aim higher. You'll hear it. Just listen for it. It comes in different varieties. It's aim higher, aim higher, aim higher. And there are different versions of this, right? There's the therapeutic journey. You could go deeper. So the goal is I go deeper in understanding of myself, and then I'll be set free. That's a pattern. So aim higher. There's the materialist story. It's accumulate more. Get more things, get more stuff, get more resources. That's another version of it. So you have the philosophical, and then you have the religious. Aim for God. What is the fundamental difference between the Christian story and every other story, ancient, modern, religious, philosophical, whatever it is? It's this. It's a matter of direction. It's the God who comes from outside of us and shines his light in. Some people get really close. One version I heard of it that gets really close is, if you read this passage, it's about sacrifice. Sacrifice will lead to all that life can bring. That's close, because it's not your sacrifice, it's mine. If you want to know the fundamental difference between the Christian story and every other story, ancient and modern, it is one of direction. It's a light that comes from outside of us and shines in our darkness. It's a gift. Would you please pray with me? God, we thank you for bending down and for breaking the barrier with us by entering into our skin, entering into our lives, by being both God and somehow us, to meet us where we are and where we are. God, we thank you for bridging barrier after barrier after barrier, bending to look at us in the face, serving us. Us who are fearful, us who are worried, us who can't drag ourselves out of the cave, out of the pit, us who are eager, us who are equally stained. God, we can't get our minds and our hearts around this news. We confess, just as in our human day-to-day lives, just in one single day, it isn't always easy to build bridges, to build a bridge like you have. The work of crossing barriers, looking at others face to face with the same love that you have had for us, that can sometimes seem impossible. So God, might we encounter you again in this story as the bending down God, the one who entered from outside into our cave, into our darkness. And might that story permeate not just our worship, and not just our theology, our thinking about you deeply, but also our hearts, our minds, our actions, our lives. We pray this in the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, in the name of the Holy Spirit, and all of God's people say.